Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink, Jack Spencer, and Mark Grebner from Practical Political Consultants. A little later, John Kavanaugh. He is the president of Epic MRA. He's going to join us to talk about the MERS survey that we have in the field that many of our listeners I know have already received or would like to receive, and we'll give some more information about what that is, where it comes from, and what you can do to participate. But first, guys, we've got to talk about the big news from last week, the decision by the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to order Michigan, the legislature in particular, to redraw the 2011 congressional and legislative maps so that they are not partisan gerrymandered. And John, what was your first reaction when you saw that, other than, God, I'm glad I'm not in the office today?
That's it. My first reaction was, what a cluster. And I won't finish the phrase, but you basically, don't you have to redraw all the districts by the time you start moving boundaries? It just seems to me like one of those puzzles where you're going to have to redo everything.
It would seem like it, wouldn't it, Mark?
I think it'd be easier to move everything. I think that it is made it a little bit more difficult by the additional constraint that you're not supposed to tamper with some of the districts. So now you've got to redraw the whole state in an impartial way, but without touching half the districts.
So there's an extra layer of complexity now on everything else that's going on in Lansing. Jack, we've got...
Yeah, which was so badly needed, right?
Yeah. We didn't have enough with road funding and no-fault insurance.
Frankly, I think that it's more of an excuse for the Republicans to do the budget and not do the road funding until after October 1st. The caveat there is I'm not sure where no-fault comes into it, whether there's going to be some kind of deal with the governor on no fault, which would then necessitate maybe them actually doing some more things. But it's an awful lot of moving parts. And when you got more moving parts, you have more of an excuse to maybe leave out this and leave out that. So it's going to be very interesting to see how which things come first and which things get put on the shelf for later.
I've got to believe, though, the governor's going to say, you know, at least maps don't have to be done until August 1, right? There's no reason you can't pass a budget, that you can't pass road funding prior to August 1. Since we know that, you know, Mike Shirkey and their legislators aren't going to be sitting down at the maps. There'll be staff members working up stuff for them to review, but there's not going to be a lawmaker sitting down, you know, drawing lines.
It'll be the opposite. The Republicans are not going to draw any maps. No, none of them will show up at any of the meetings. None of them will meet any of the deadlines. Why in the world would you participate? The only thing you'd do is you'd miss your deadlines. That'd be the goal. And you'd file objections, and you'd file maybe something that's incorrect. You might do that. And you might complain about the other side. And you might rush into random courts with emergency filings to see if you can't get somebody to issue an emergency stay somewhere to screw up something else. But
so
there's
that's
no
the idea, to muck everything up.
Right. That's the reason that this can never actually work. The Republicans, and I'm not just talking about the legislature, but the Republican Party, the Republican staff, the legislature, and all the Republican judges, right, are simply going to try to stick something in the spokes to break this thing down. And this is a process that's already so fragile that it's going to be easy to screw this up. Won't a federal court stay it? Won't a state court issue some other order?
Will the Supreme Court go ahead and take it up? And we've got this issue with the efficiency gap in North Carolina, in Maryland, Wisconsin. They're trying to test this theory. Wouldn't it make sense that the Supreme Court of the United States would want to take this up and nip this in the bud so we don't have every other state in the union coming rushing to the courts and saying, hey, we've got partisan gerrymandering here too?
Well, I don't think that there are many cases in other states which are advanced sufficiently far to be presented to the Supreme Court.
But I'm talking over time, like 5-10 years from now.
Well, by that time, there will be a jurisprudence. I think this is kind of the end of an era in redistricting law. The Supreme Court is probably going to hand something down in the two pending cases, which will at least clear their docket for the future. So I think that we're at the end of a basketball game and a small fist fight breaks out. And what we're watching is the fist fight.
So you don't think that when it comes down to it in 2020, we're going to be electing a new state senator in Ingham County?
No, I don't believe. I think that I'm guessing, but I don't think that the chance of actually having new elections in new districts in 2020, I don't think that chance is as much as 5%.
You put it at 5%. What do you think, Jack?
Oh, I agree that they're not going to do it, but I don't think that has anything to do with the excuse of one more thing and being able to delay things you want to delay, as far as particularly road funding, possibly.
Because you're saying they don't want to do road funding.
I think it's pretty obvious now, since they've said it separated, that they definitely, the Republicans, the they I'm speaking about here are the Republican lawmakers, they want to do the budget and then hit the road funding. And I think it's a little surprising that nobody's pointed out that that means they don't have the October 1st deadline on the road funding, if they do it in that order, because that's not, you know, you don't have to get that. They could do it November 1st. I really think that's what the Republicans want to do. They want to lengthen it out. They want to hand her a budget. The other interesting thing is, I think they may, if they do it too soon, it may actually be a mistake. I think it'd be harder for the governor to veto it if they got it done, the budget done, let's say, the 1st of August. Than it would be for her to veto it if they did it, got it done, let's say, the 1st of July. How do you veto a budget that's already accelerated the road funding? You know, the Republicans are going to come back, and she just vetoed our acceleration of road
funding. Yeah, we're going to put $1.2 billion into the roads, and she just vetoed it. I see what you're saying, that they're not going to want to do that. Mark, I want to come back to, let's say the 5% happens, and we do have to redraw maps. Now, you had advanced a legal theory to me that kind of throws into question this whole idea that state senators can only be elected two times, and that it's possible that, let's say, someone like Tom Barrett in the 24th District would have to run for re-election in 2020 after only serving 2 years, and then would serve two more years until 2022 and be term limited and couldn't run again. You're saying that that may not necessarily be the case.
Whenever you deal with a problem like this, you have to think about who's going to finally make the decisions and where they're going to be made. If this all happened, in other words, we have special elections for state senate in 2020, then somebody has got to decide how to apply term limits. But here's the deal. The federal courts are not going to make that decision because it's not before them. The proper parties aren't before them. The question hasn't been briefed. It simply isn't part of their problem. It's a problem to be solved later. Well, it can't be solved later because all sorts of people want to know if they're even eligible. I mean, in Tom Barrett's case, it's a question whether he would be term limited. But in other cases, like, say, Curtis Hertel, can he run at all?
Yeah.
I mean, he's already run twice. I mean, he's already run once. I'm sorry, he's already run twice. And so he'd be ineligible to complete the last 2 years of his term.
Right.
Well, somebody's going to have to resolve that. I suppose it's got to be a state court. And I suppose you've got Republicans filing here and Democrats filing there and people suing and claiming the Secretary of State should make a decision and other people saying that the AG should issue an opinion and the legislature saying, no, we don't want an opinion from the AG. We want the Michigan Supreme Court. And you're trying to do all this after the districts are drawn because we won't know who is eligible to run in what seats until after that and before the filing deadline, which is less than a year away from now.
No, that's a good point.
The whole thing is like impossible.
Well, the state court system, though, can operate very quickly when it's an election-related matter. So, I mean, you could expedite something and get an answer maybe by next March if all this happens, if all the dominoes fall right. Is this wishful thinking on my part?
Oh, you might get one by March, which would mean that you would have elections for important state offices, Congress, U.S. Senate, State Senate and State House, where people are making decisions in March with an April filing deadline, right? Not knowing if the $1 million they've raised is they can spend it or if they're not going to be able to spend it, whether they're term limited or not term limited. I mean, just imagine the mess that we're going to have as all of this unfolds late, with the very great possibility somewhere that somebody will finally block the entire redistricting and call the election off for the state senate. The whole thing is madness.
Well, John summed it up. He said cluster.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, I'm thinking here, the more you talk about it, Mark, I'm thinking of potential primary opponents filing things, all kinds of stuff.
There's another thing that I wanted to touch on before we go to John, and that is this perception, Jack, that you brought up last week that I think is an interesting one regarding Dana Nessel and whether Dana Nessel is the Democrats' version of Donald Trump at the state level. And there are some ways that they are not similar, but in some ways they are.
Oh, I think the similarity that I was pointing out, and I can't even remember which issues, I can't keep up with all of them, was the Republicans responding to Dana Nessels on one decision. And at the time the Republican response came, it was like 48 hours later, she had done two other things. And I think my comparison with Trump is I think she moves so quickly from issue to issue that I've just noticed the Republicans are going to have, are they going to have the same effect that Trump had on Democrats, where they would be going after Trump on one thing and you'd think this is a massive thing and you almost would have forgotten about that issue a week later because he brought up three other things. And I think Dana Nessel has, so far, I think there's a very big similarity in that, where the Republicans are going to have to focus on one thing and stick to it. If they jump, try to jump from one thing to the other the way she is, I think she's fine. How are they going to make an issue out of anything that, for only 48 hours?
She is hard to keep up. And she is very blunt. She's very plain spoken. She has a lot of charisma. She has a band of followers. Mark, you're shaking your head, though. You don't like this comparison.
I don't like the comparison at all. I mean, Donald Trump is really a kind of like a one-off individual. That may be exactly the right phrase. Really, he's not technically competent. He doesn't know anything. Dana Nessel, for all of her explosiveness, is quite competent at law. And she actually, although she doesn't keep them, she does a good job of selecting very qualified, competent people. I mean, so at a technical level, until something goes wrong, her department runs pretty well. And so I just don't think, I mean, she's a pretty formidable adversary for the Republicans. I mean, she really does a pretty good job of advancing the agenda she's on, and she knows what she's doing, and she remembers what she's said, and so forth. I mean, she's not going to, you're not going to find her admitting having lied the day after tomorrow. I mean, she doesn't lie, right? So anyway, I just think that, you know, there's an aspect of Trump, which is his ability to sort of, like, we're all bulls, and he's the bullfighter, right, for flashing the cape and leading us all to become confused. And maybe Dana Nessel has a little bit of that. But as far as the overall ability to run an office, she's well within the normal range of office holders in Michigan and the United States.
From a political lightning rod standpoint, though, John, she is the closest thing we have
Trump. She has the potential to cause controversy on Twitter. She's an active user of Twitter. She's a lightning rod for the other party. I mean, those are two strong similarities. I mean, I don't know if I'd go beyond that.
There's another aspect here, too. She does have a belief system that maybe Donald Trump does not. You know that she comes in with certain issues. You know that she stands.
Yeah, you can predict pretty much where she's going to land and what she's going to do on issues based on her history and where she is politically. Whereas with him, I mean, he could switch the light, hit the light switch on something the next day and completely reverse course.
Right. You know that she's firm on equal rights, especially for the LGBTQ community. You know that she's against Line 5.
I think on those things, that may make sense on whether she can keep it up, and because she's consistent, so maybe she can't continue to keep up the pace of switching issues the way she has. But I'm not talking about getting in her head or getting in Donald Trump's head. I'm talking about her effect on her political opponents. Mm-hmm. She has moved so quickly from one to another, and I still don't, I'm sure there are segments of the news media that still haven't figured out with Trump, hey, we had all these great issues, but they don't realize it's not that great an issue if it only lasts a week and you're talking about something different a week later. And I still think that's a big part of how Trump has succeeded. And so far, I think Dana Nessel has moved from this to this to this so quickly, the Republicans can't keep up.
Good point there, Jack. Mark, you do have a suspicion here before we go on to our next guest. What is the suspicion in regards to this redistricting stuff?
The whole redistricting strategy on the Democratic side seems sort of insane.
What do you mean?
Like it can't possibly work. Like we've put together a scheme and we've added a plot to it and a cabal and like a witch's coven somewhere, and then we're going to sneak up on them, and it's like way too complicated. And so I have a suspicion which has no evidence at all, but I just want to say it out loud.
Please.
Somewhere this craziness emerged. Where could the Democratic Party have found such legal craziness? I'll bet you that underneath it all is Mark Brewer.
Well, I don't think that's too far of a stretch.
No.
I think that's right. Well, and let's go back in time here, because I think this is where you're going, that we have this multi-tiered this strategy of trying to upset the apple cart on redistricting, since it's been in the Republican and the Chamber of Commerce's hands for at least the last two, if not three, redistricting cycles. And so now, in trying to muck everything up, we had the redistricting commission that went on the ballot, is what you're saying. We have this lawsuit that the League of Women Voters has put out there. So you just roll those two things out there, and maybe something sticks. And in this case, maybe both of them are sticking.
Well, the Voters Not Politician petition drive did stick.
Right.
And Brewer opposed it almost all the way through. He was one of the people dragging his feet and trying to interfere with it. Okay, so the fact that, you know, he has his own branch, if he's really the person behind this most recent one, is typical Mark Brewer legal craziness. The idea that we would only do this to affect one election at the last possible minute, we're going to go at the last election held in a five election cycle, you know, the 10-year redistricting cycle, with a whole new system coming in 2022. So we're going to have this bizarre Hail Mary pass thrown at the last minute in 2020 and hold an election unlike any that Michigan has ever held before, with a process that isn't defined, and where we're going to have this done by the courts, which is there a Democratic majority anywhere on a court that we could possibly eke out enough to get a pro-Democratic decision, right? Mm. It just can't work. There are too many things here which are too fragile. You don't know exactly how it's going to break down. I mean, which piece of this is going to break down? Is it the U.S. Supreme Court that will intervene? Will the Republicans run out the clock locally? Will the Sixth Circuit have an on-bank decision to reverse the three-judge panel? I mean, we don't know exactly how it'll break down, but it's just bound to break down because it's just too many pieces, and it's just too unlikely, and it just has, in my mind, the savor of Mark Brewer.
I don't disagree with that. I think it's all about the strategy here is we want to put all our bet down on one election, 2020, don't look beyond that, and really take a crack that our best chance is to just win as much as we can in 2020. I don't disagree with Mark at all on whether it's going to actually happen or not. I don't think it's going to.
Well, listen, though, Mark, if Mark Brewer is successful in establishing an efficiency gap and partisan gerrymandering as a top-tier thing you must consider when you're redrawing maps, this is something that the Redistricting Commission has to keep in the front of their mind when they're drawing the maps in 2022. So you could argue that what he's doing right now has much bigger implications than just 2020. This could set a new path for drawing maps way out into the future.
In the first place, the Michigan decision does not hinge on what was called the efficiency gap, which I happen to think is mathematically unsound. Those arguments made by the plaintiffs in the two other state cases, this is actually a much more ingenious and clever mathematical system. Very well written up in 538.com. Had a wonderful column explaining the mathematics of it. It's very difficult. It's very good. There are serious mathematicians behind the Michigan claims. Okay, I just want to say that off to the side.
Okay.
Other than that, though, I'm not sure that the VNP panel will be required to do anything. They are allowed to take a notice of other decisions and so forth. But because they will be their own panel, they're pretty much exempt from the partisan gerrymandering standards. That would be my guess. Because they're essentially created as a nonpartisan entity, and they'll be free to create their own criteria.
Yeah, but if the Republicans don't like what they come up with, maybe they come back with this same partisan gerrymandering stuff and take it to the court, and now we've got precedent.
I don't think an attack on a gerrymandering or a redistricting proposal adopted by the new panel in 2022, I don't think it'll be susceptible to attack on a partisan basis.
Okay.
Because it has been created in the state constitution as a method of nonpartisan reapportionment. The claim in Michigan and in the other states was that the Republican Party, well, in Maryland, in the case the Democratic Party, but a political party controlled the process to the exclusion of the other party. I don't think that this is going to be vulnerable to such an attack.
Okay.
So really, this entire kerfuffle here is a one-time event. I mean, even if the Hail Mary pass succeeds, it's only one football game, it's only one touchdown, and it'll be forgotten except sort of as a bizarre footnote.
20, 30 years from now.
4 years from now. Because we're going to be holding new elections in 2022 in all these districts. The state Senate, the state House, the Congress, completely new districts with no connection with the districts adopted in 2022.
All right. Mark Grebner, thanks for coming in. We're going to bring in John Kavanaugh here in just a second. Mark Grebner leaves here. We escaped a conversation on topology, I guess. I don't know what topology is, but John Kavanaugh is here with a bunch of numbers from Epic MRA. John, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm probably a poor substitute to the first string in Bernie Porn, but he's unable to make it today.
Well, we appreciate you coming here. And the reason we brought you over here, first and foremost, is MERS is in the midst of doing its insider survey. And John, tell our listeners what it is that we're doing right now and why we do it.
This is every 2 years what we do is an insider survey with Epic MRA, and we ask who folks think the most effective association is, who they think the most effective multi-client lobbyist is, who they think the most effective multi-client lobbying firm is. Basically, it's sort of the horse race among Lansing professionals, includes PR firms, includes news media, who's the best in what folks think.
And this is basically a chance for our readers and the folks who we communicate with to kind of express their opinion on who they think is doing the best out there and who's being the most efficient. And we don't get a lot of this opportunity in this town. And if we have a chance for folks to kind of pat themselves on the back or award good work or recognize good work, well, we'll go ahead and take that opportunity.
Yep, and it's nice, too, because John and his colleagues at Epic have done some work to make sure that there isn't ballot stuffing, to make sure we're actually measuring the community. I think we're sending out, I want to say it's 1,600-some invites to participate. That includes all the lawmakers, the department directors, the lobby corps. We use the Truscott Rossman Lobby Guide is sort of the core group of people we send the invite to. And then we add some folks like the Supreme Court, the Legislative Service Bureau, some folks that might not normally be listed in a lobby guide. So we kind of expand the universe a little bit that way.
Anything you want to add on as far as that aspect goes of it? It sounds pretty complicated, though, what you guys are trying to do, or what we're doing here.
It's immensely complicated. No, not particularly complicated. It is a lot of, there is considerable effort that goes into it. And inevitably, there are those who have their noses out of joint because perhaps they didn't get enough opportunities to vote for their particular firm or their favorite. But MERS and Epic MRA have worked over the past couple of these to try to, as John noted, at least mitigate the possibility of ballot box stuffing. I recall back in its early years, it was I had heard rumors of the ability to go pick up a big pile of paper ballots. When it first started, that's how it was done, I think. It was pencil and paper. Now we send out emails and it's an online activity. So that allows for a little bit more efficient culling of what are possibly efforts to advance some interests.
So the people who get these surveys, are they legislators, lobbyists, or anybody in the Rossman Guide?
That's the core, as John noted, is the lobby guide. And then added to it are legislators, Supreme Court, some of the, I believe, the fiscal agencies, and perhaps the Council Administrator's Office, Legislative Service Bureau, in order to cast the net as widely as possible so that it just isn't among those whose profession it is to urge legislation on one side or the other, i.e. lobbyists.
Okay. And so if you're a legislator and you haven't gotten one of these surveys yet, should you be worried that you got missed out here?
Worried might not be, but maybe scratch your head, how come I didn't? But
so that, what do they do?
They would give our office a call, okay, or you, and they post haste. Their email address would be acquired, and off the invitation would go.
So have we already sent out everything then? Have we sent out all the requests? So if you haven't gotten yours yet, then...
Yes, for those listening to this podcast who believe that they have been left off the list, give a call to either Epic MRA or MERS, and we'll take down your contact information via email address and get an invitation out to you.
And how long do they have to fill out the survey?
We're cutting it off on May 10th.
And then how long does it take to compile results after that?
These are an awful lot of open-ended questions, so it's about a week's worth of compilation that goes
And
into
because
it.
We have some times where you may just not, you may have different spellings of names. Folks could have written something. You got to kind of decipher what did they mean by that. So that gets a little...
Yeah, and part of the refinement of the survey instrument itself over the years has been a move toward trying to standardize the response categories. But there's no getting around the fact that if you've got an open-ended question and the spelling is done incorrectly, it takes some subjective figuring out. I guess it wouldn't be artificial intelligence friendly.
But there's no hanging chads.
There are no hanging chads, no.
And then once we have the results, John, we usually put them out right around the Mackinac Policy Conference, don't we?
Usually I like to release them when people are driving up to the island so the winners can be all congratulatory and have a reason to drink more, and that the losers can be feel some pity and have a reason to drink some more.
But the idea is that everybody should be in a celebratory mood anyway, and there's already parties, and you're on Mackinac Island, and opportunity to congratulate the winners and good spirits around.
Yep. And one of the things that I want to mention to our listeners who kind of look at this poll, and John can attest to this, is the fact that over the six or seven, I think this might be the seventh one we've done, the results have been remarkably consistent, which means to me that we're actually measuring the known universe as far as Lansing insiders. That we've got an instrument that's pretty accurate. There's slight changes in individual performances. Some firms have done better in the scale, but overall we've consistent. The winning organizations have remained pretty consistent.
I concur with that. I mean, if you take a look at the top seven mentions of any of those categories, they'll jockey for various slots in those top seven, but rarely do you see a newcomer. Among individuals, obviously retirements, moving on to a different job, sometimes has an effect on that, but typically not much.
So that's going on right now. And John, obviously, we're always interested in polling information and what you might be seeing out there. I see you brought your folder with some polling results here. What's been catching your eye lately?
I was listening to your earlier segment and the question of Dana Nessel and Trump and so forth. I would concur in part with an assessment of her being a tough target to pin down because she moves so quickly. Where I might digress is she doesn't believe would make as good a foil for Michigan Republicans as Donald Trump does for National Democrats. Our latest survey in March had her name recognition below 50%. So to the extent folks want to use her as a foil, I think it increases her name ID, which might not be a bad thing from her perspective. Otherwise, I think some things of note. I did notice this morning that Biden captured the firefighters union endorsement, the first major union to make an endorsement in the Dem primary, which is an interesting circumstance. Our last survey in March had a question on vote to reelect on Donald Trump, and union membership was not that far different from overall numbers on the vote to reelect.
So as union members went, so did the rest of the Democratic primary voters.
No, not really. I mean, the numbers were for the question read, thinking about the 2020 general, if the election were held today, would you definitely vote to reelect Donald Trump? Would you consider voting for someone else, or will you definitely vote to replace him? And the vote to replace was at 49%, and the vote to reelect was at 31% among Michigan voters. We had a almost dead even self-ID'd partisan split. So that number emerges as independent. Those few, 13% or so of the survey respondents, moved heavily toward vote to replace in order to get the overall numbers where they were. More to my original point, however, is that among union members themselves and union households, the vote to reelect numbers were not that much different than the overall
number. So what you're saying is that there is still some union support, a lot of, comparatively, union support with Donald Trump.
Yes, at least as evidenced in our last survey. Interestingly, as well, in that particular question, those who consider themselves pro-life are less adamant about reelecting him than those who consider themselves pro-choice are adamant about replacing. That holds fairly true across other demographics too, like self-ID'd party. While it's true that Republicans are more apt to vote to reelect, that not as strenuously as Democrats are to replace. A survey we conducted last year, right about this time in April, had a matchup between Trump and Biden. And
Biden won, didn't he?
Biden won. Our self-ID'd party ID was 43 Dem, 41 Republican among those who took the survey, and that was their self-ID. And Biden took 52-39% of the vote. That was right in the midst of, I believe, his Macomb County rally as well when that was taken. The only point I'm raising is that while we haven't done a straight-up Dem primary poll in Michigan, those would seem to me to indicate that he would, in Michigan, do at least as well as the trend has been nationally, and that is to head the field, albeit by a narrow margin over the next highest one, Sanders. I did see a Washington Post ABC News poll out this morning where they ask Democratic primary voters, who are you voting for? And better than half didn't have an answer.
Yeah.
It's when you line up the candidates and force a choice that Biden emerges typically around 4 to 6 points over Bernie Sanders.
So here we are April 29. What should we make out of that? It shouldn't be all that surprising. We've got a lot of undecideds, and the people with the biggest name ID are doing the best right now in the polling. That's not a surprise, should it be?
Not horribly, although I think it's interesting to note the strategy that seems to be emerging in the Biden campaign, and that is to capture the prototypical union household. That Washington Post survey that I just cited also led out their interview with what's more important to you, ideology or the ability to beat Trump. And that scales by age. The younger you are, the more important that your candidate match your views. And once you get to middle age, it's more important that whoever gets nominated has the best chance at beating the incumbent.
Isn't that kind of predictable?
It is somewhat predictable, but the telling tale is in the extent to which a lesson, if any, was learned by the more ideologically pure Democratic primary voters, the lesson learned out of 2016. And that is disenchantment with the primary process and non-enthusiasm for Clinton's candidacy.
Wouldn't we be able to say that what Biden's doing, going for closer to the blue collar, if I'm understanding you right, a voter, that would make sense considering the field, wouldn't it? I mean, everybody else is going to divide everything else up and he'll be in a better position.
I would think so if, for instance, you wanted to label those candidates as establishment, if you will, for lack of a better word, and progressive. The progressive field has about, what, 17 different flavors of progressive you can choose from. So it doesn't surprise me that with Bernie Sanders being the top of them, the rest of them having a, notwithstanding the fact that many of them have had much success in raising money, O'Rourke comes to mind, they still are having a difficult time distinguishing themselves from the rest of the pack.
John Cavanaugh with Epic MRA, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to John Cavanaugh for coming in. Jack, John, Mark Grebner for coming in. I'm glad Mark was able to come in and wake up a little early for us. He was a little groggy. He said he'd only do it for us because I'm sure at 10 o'clock in the morning was... That's a tough ask.
He's a late afternoon evening guy, isn't he?
Yeah, he tends to be. After we got done talking to him, he was talking about that Politics 538 article about how this complex mathematical legal theory had helped win this court case for them.
I might have to go back and read that, but if it involves math, I know I'll need a calculator.
Yeah, it sounded to me like the kind of thing that would really be appreciated by those who maybe when they relax, they just do trigonometry problems just for the fun of it. It seemed extremely complex to me.
Yeah, it was it's something that you can only do these days, where you basically have a computer and you just plug in this formula and the particular different types of maps that could emerge from that formula, and then see what ended up being and compare it to the whole entire universe of possibilities. And essentially what they're saying is what came out is about as Republican as you could possibly make it.
I guess.
And that's why... the court did the thing that it did.
When can we just have all these things done by the robots? Wouldn't that be an easier solution?
Yeah, maybe we could put that in the Constitution. The robots determine the congressional.
And maybe next decade, the big question for the U.S. Supreme Court to deal with is, can robots run for office?
Then the debate is the robot leaning Democrat or leaning Republican? And we got to debate that, and you're right back where you began.
That sounds very sci-fi, guys. Yeah. Yeah, we've just given an ingenious writer out there an idea for a movie script. We're going to see this in like 5 years, just the way
you go.
The robots who picked our leaders. Thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.